Okay, today's May 3rd. We're Bible in the Ancient Near East. And we're doing number 5 on our syllabus, which is Wisdom Literature. And there's a reading in the Choveret called An Introduction to Old Testament Study. And it's page 321, a chapter on Israelite Wisdom Literature. Okay. Now, simply because there's just so much biblical material out there, we have, the Tanakh is thousands and thousands of pages, and it's parallel to the ancient world. You know, what do we have? We have a few pages, a few stones here, a few here, there. There's so many different words of wisdom in the Tanakh. 10 and 12 yourselves right now. Even the words like tushiyah, things like that, you know, the idea of wisdom was so well developed that it produced so many different words and cognitive levels of thinking, right? In English, of course, it produced many words too. We've developed it so many years. You can have knowledge, you can have comprehension, right? So you have Chokhmah, there's also Bina, there's Das, there's Mada. It's between Das and Mada, right? Mada appears a few times in Tanakh. So we have so many different words, like what we said at the very beginning of the semester. Why in the Torah, in the Tanakh, there are 20 different words for rain, right? You know maybe 4 or 5, but did you know Zarzif? Si'irim? Some of these words are even onomatopoetic. But there's only one word for snow, and then it's obvious why. Okay? So wisdom has been such an important element of development of the character of the authors of these works in Tanakh, that there's so many different words. As opposed to ancient Near Eastern parallels, we hardly come up to much. Chokhmah was not, for the average Mesopotamian or Sumerian, an important element of life. He would rather be at a drinking party of his god El and enjoy life and take care of his family and have a successful crop. It wasn't much more than that. All right, and serve his god as much as possible to help us win the next battle. Okay. In the midst of this, we're producing Sefer Mishlei, okay, which Hayes points out very nicely, requires a huge amount of side knowledge to just come up with what he writes about. And the true same is true about Eov as well. You just know so much about vegetation, about animals, about owls, about ants, about camels. There's just so much in there about the nature of laziness and the nature of thrift, and it stays the test of time. It's amazing. The problem with Mishlei is it's not well organized. Right? You can have a pasuk that talks about the ills of adultery, and 2 psukim later you have a discussion about thriftiness, and 2 psukim later about the problems of being too jealous, or the problems of being too angry. Mishlei has been codified. Number of books, perhaps the most popular of them, is about 800 years old. It's called Orchos Tzadikim. Are you familiar with it? So popular, translated. Orchos Tzadikim is of an unknown author. Some say it's the Rosh, some say it's the Talmud of the Ramban. It doesn't matter. What it does is it classifies all of the issues, all the Chokhmah of Mishlei, into chapters. Right? Okay, it gives order to Sefer Mishlei. It's called Orchos Tzadikim. Okay, so that's just a starter. Is that there's such a broad definition of Chokhmah. Now, there's an underlying assumption behind all the books of Tanakh that are dedicated to wisdom literature. That would be Mishlei, Iyov, Koheles, and I'm going to put in this even Tehillim. Right? Tehillim, Mishlei, Iyov, Koheles. Tehillim, Mishlei, Iyov are known by an acronym of the Russia tables backwards, Sifrei Emet, Iyov, Mishlei, Tehillim. They're called books of truth. These are books that help us deal with the vicissitudes and problems of our daily existence and development. So I'll put into this Koheles as well. Certainly there is a pasuk here and there in Yeshayahu and Koheles and Amos that deal with the existential problems of man. But these three books are largely dedicated to these issues. Okay, and the underlying assumption of the four books is that while none of them really give you an outline how to acquire knowledge, right? The assumption from the Torah. Right? Torah creates a certain certain appreciation for our values, right? And but I don't have any pasuk in the Torah like Reishis Chochma Yiras Hashem. I have a pasuk that says Es Hashem Elokei Chatira. Okay, but let's see the development of this kind of thought. So I start with the following. When you want to sit down and write something about what are our struggles in life. So the first thing you might recognize is, you know, as troubled as we may be now, you can't imagine what it's like to be alive 3,500 years ago, where every single day, you know, just think of it, we have conveniences. And the poorest among us have conveniences more than the richest Roman emperor had. Right? But their daily struggles of how to eliminate yesterday's wastes, right? Where? When? And, you know, they didn't have refrigeration, for goodness sakes. They're eating spoiled food all the time. And they're, all right, we've messed things up ourselves with some of the things we eat and some of our unintended consequences of some of the conveniences that we want. All right, so we have to invent other things to help us deal with those problems that we made for ourselves. But the idea of every day not knowing if your child makes it home from wherever they go in the morning because of marauders or the next town that keeps on incurring with incursions and who knows what else. Every day it was just another problem for which you have to pay shomel by our standards just to get through the day, right? So when you're living under such a framework, so don't be surprised that there's a Torah that comes out and says there's a cheshbon to your life, and you're held responsible, right? You do A, this will happen. You do B, that will happen. And there's a cheshbon. Don't just live out your life for your pleasure. The basic thrust of religion is to put off satisfaction, put off your reward system for a later time, right? And our stories, I think I presented this to you early on in the semester. Our stories, especially Sefer Bereishis, give us a preparation for this. Right? Someone who is mitzachek has to be cast out of the house. Right? Because he will be a bad influence on... what's the guy's name? His younger brother.
Yes.
Yitzchok. Right? So the reader has to be careful and analyze that to say the mitzachek is living for the moment. That's what mitzachek means. The yitzchok is, like batizchak liyom acharon. Ozimoli spoke pinu. He's putting off his satisfaction. So there's no small difference just between these two brothers, right? Between Esav, let's say, who happens to be the father-in-law of this mitzachek. Esav who says, Hinei anochi oleich lamus v'lo mezali b'chorai. That's for the moment. I don't live for before. I live for today. And today, I see a lot of death in the fields every day. I'm thinking of today. And Yaakov is thinking down the line. So there are moral twists and turns in between. But this is one basic thrust. You're not living for the moment. Okay, fine. Fair enough. So this animates such mitzvahs as Taras and Mishpacha. Put off your connection right now because it'll lead to something much greater in a later time. Right? The days pass anyway, so don't. It's okay. Let it pass without being next to your wife, and then you'll see what it's like after a week when you come back together. Or many mitzvahs of this sort, where we're troubled, we're taught to analyze life. You read Plato's Republic, you see Socrates is not for no reason. Does the Rambam suggest that Aristotle converted to Judaism? But it was, of course, there are those who could suggest that the Rambam converted to Islam. But be it as it may, someone who feels that a life not analyzed is not worth living, would normally be drawn to this kind of approach. Okay, so then you're writing your book and you're a wise person and you see, wait, God, you keep telling us that if I do A, right, A will happen. If I do B, B will happen. So probably the earliest that challenge to this is made, there's a whole book that challenges this, which is Koheles, right? But much earlier in Bereishis, someone makes a challenge to this. And this challenge, there's no parallel in the ancient world of a human being who has the chutzpah to look up to his God and say, Hashofet kol ha'aretz lo yaseh mishpat. Right? Now, that's not to say that there's no one in the ancient world who rebels against their God. Alright? But they're not doing it out of a sense of mishpat. Right, when Daniel, for instance, right, rebels, or in the Epic of Gilgamesh, the salvation from the wrath of the gods in the flood stories. So when the human being rebels against the deity, it happens in ancient Near Eastern literature, but it's not that the chutzpah. I'm not saying that Avram is rebelling when he turns to God about God's plans with Sodom, but just think of the immense chutzpah of telling the deity that you're trying to spread around the world. Hashofet kol aretz lo yaseh mishpat. God should pick up this little puny human and say, "Who are you to tell me what mishpat is?" Which is essentially what God does with Eov at the end of his book. We'll get to that shortly. All right. So who are you to tell me? Your idea of mishpat? You have the big picture in front of you? Right? Those who have ever studied Eov know that's how Eov ends. God picks up Eov and says, Eov, let me show you the cosmos. And you still have a question? Right? But Adam gets away with it. Right? Because God wants man engaged. You know what? Avram, tell me, what do you have in mind? What's your point? God, I'm spreading your word to everybody about doing A and you get this, doing B and you get that, and what are you doing? Cholila, that you should make the tzaddik and the rasha share the same fate? Anyone know there's a pasuk in Koheles that does one better than this? Not just that the tzaddik and the rasha share the same things. What does Koheles say in chapter 9? I see the rasha getting what the tzaddik deserves based on what I'm taught, and I see the tzaddik getting what the rasha deserves. Known in the Gemara and the famous Ephes Brothers is tzaddik v'ralo rasha v'tovlo. Right? Which one should bother you more? It's a philosophical question asked by Mephoshim to chapter 12. Look at that. Chapter 12 of Yirmiyahu, where that prophet seeing all sorts of hurt going on, he says, Madua derech rishaim tzolecha. Yirmiyahu has one question to ask God, and he says, why do the wicked thrive so much? So Brahmanel asks the obvious question, Yirmiyahu, you got one question, why didn't you ask the opposite? Why do the righteous suffer so much? So Brahmanel just answers him, he was no gay. People might think he's just complaining about his own lot, right? He's complaining. Madua derech rishaim tzolecha. Namely, Rashi and the Mefarshim can duke it out. Which Rishayim is he talking about? Because some Mefarshim say he's talking about the success of the Babylonians. Some say, more realistically, from the following Pesukim, that he's talking about wicked Israelites. Right? All right, I'll leave that for Parshanut. But this is what Avram goes easy. He says, because that's the situation in front of him. But other wisdom literature is very pessimistic about these promises. God, what is going on here? Okay, question.
Is this the rehashing of Tzapet and Mitzvah?
I'm past that already by now. But Koheles Dafka does not rely on an answer like that. I'll get to that in a minute. All right? Your Eov very conveniently ends with this sufferer getting everything back. That doesn't always happen. I know lots of people for whom that didn't happen. Well, the answer goes on that. Right? So it's not an ironclad answer, and Koheles doesn't rely on one. Now, back to another point that you would have gotten by now in a survey or an intro class, is that five books of the Tanakh had their canonicity questioned. Right? With me, five books. Kohelis is one of them. Right? Each one, you know, in my intro class, we usually draw a chart. We write down the five books, what are the objections that Chazal had in them, and we write down the four or five objections to each book. Well, how did they resolve those objections? Because in the end, these five books are part of Tanakh. Right? But you have whole schools. You have the school of Beit Shammai. They felt that Kohelis is not part of Tanakh. Or that Esther is not part of Tanakh. But the five books are Kohelis, Mishlei, Shir, Shirim, Esther, and Yechezkel. Alright, so the Talmud responded to them, and when you get all the responses, you can create criteria whereby Chazal felt a book needs to have in order to be in Tanakh. So that other books like Mishlei Ben Sira, books of the Apocrypha, were excluded, especially the books of the New Testament. Okay? Alright, so to the point that the Mishnah says, HaKorei B'Sfarim Chitzoniyim Eino Chelek Lo'olam Haba. Don't even read those books. Alright? But really what the Gemara Mishnah means, the Gemara itself says, and that's how the test in Sanhedrin, is that don't read them as Tanakh. Don't read them as if though these books are Tanakh. You can read them. There's evidence in the Talmud that the rabbis read the New Testament. And they certainly read the Apocrypha, because the Apocrypha is quoted many times in the Talmud. There's a big Tosfos in Daf Samachei at Erevin that quotes all the places where the Talmud quotes the Apocrypha. Right? So when it says don't read the books, these books, it doesn't mean don't read them b'chlal. It means don't read them qua Tanakh. What does it mean to do that? What does it mean to read, this we're playing Hoffman Shakespeare, but don't read it as Tanakh. Read Mishlei. Pass me. This can't be that much fun. Come on. If you read Mishlei like you read Tanakh, that means that you approach it in a certain way that you don't approach, let's say it's parallel, Mishlei Ben Sira. Familiar with that book? Right? The Proverbs of Ben Sira. It's part of the Apocrypha. That's certainly the most widely quoted book of the Apocrypha in the Talmud. Right? So when the Talmud, the Tzadik Test in the Sefer Sanhedrin, says why it's not part of Tanakh, right? When it makes similar arguments about Mishlei and David. Certain things in Sefer Mishlei, right, that's in Tanakh, Tila Mishlei Iyot, that are, certainly by our standards today, do not stand the test of time. You know, the favorite pasuk I like to quote in this context, in the wisdom of Mishlei, is something that may have been true from his day until about 50 years ago. But I'm sorry to say, you don't like to do this with Tanakh, but I am emphatically sure that it's not true today. And it's more cleansed form, it's spare the rod and spoil the child. In the Mishlei pure form, it's if you do not beat your child, you hate him. Alright? Choseich shifto so nei b'no. Right? So what does this mean? I remember fifth, sixth grade teachers. I'm just clapping around a little bit, hit you right on the ear if you fell asleep. I'm talking about, you know, stuff that you get arrested for today. Alright? And I still run into those teachers sometimes. Okay, so that was, I'm sure, from the time of Mishlei until, you know, none of you probably remember getting potch, you know, I know, so if you give even a kid on the part of the body that God created for such things to make sure you don't run out in front of red lights and then, or pull tails of dogs and stuff like that. And if you would give a kid a patch like that on the city bus, there's a policeman waiting at the next stop with handcuffs. Right? Don't do that in public. Alright? Don't do it in private either. Alright? It's pretty much agreed that physical any type of physical punishment does not get its job done. And it usually makes the kid do it to their children. It's a terrible cycle. And it usually doesn't end with a patch. What does it mean? So this is what it means to read Tanakh as Tanakh. When I say Choseich Shifto Sonei B'no, reinterpret one of those four words. Choseich Shifto Sonei B'no. If you hold back the Shevet, which means a whip. Shevet is a scepter, is a stick, is a yardstick. Right? Who hasn't seen some kind of movie where the mother superior not hitting the kid with a yardstick on it? But as you know, it's So the what is Chosech Shivto so Nevena? Go ahead, work with me. Reinterpret one of those four words.
Reinterpret Shivto to mean like instead of a rod, like your tribe, your tradition. I don't know.
Okay, alright. I like that. It's not really what the traditional fortune do today, but it's good. Chosech Shivto. You don't teach your child your Shavit background, but that doesn't. How does that move away from a counter argument and say my tribe means we, our tribe, we kick around our kids. But you're on the right track. Nope. In Tanakh, open up a concordance, look up the word Shevet, and you'll see Shevet does mean
rulership.
A number of things. Like rulership, it could be the tribe, it could be a staff, it could be a whip. Right? But specifically, Yeshayahu uses Shevet to describe the tongue. Shevet is also a stick. In other words, it's not necessarily mean, although it for 2,500 years, that's how people understood it. Right? The Gemaras and Makos that seem to say so explicitly. Right? And I'll just tangentially tell you that the Mishnah says if you kill someone while performing a mitzvah, you do not go into galus. Right? If you kill someone inadvertently while doing a mitzvah, you don't go into galus. You build a sukkah, and you were careless, and a piece of wood falls and hits someone right in the face, the head, and kills them. You don't go into galus for that. Okay, it was inadvertent, unintentional for sure, a mistake, a terrible thing, but you don't go into galus because he was doing in the middle of doing a mitzvah. So the Gemara gives examples of this, one of which is a teacher or father is beating the kid to discipline the kid, and the kid dies in the beating. How do you mean to kill him? So one might say that person shouldn't go into galus because he doesn't have the right to go into galus. He's open season on the family members because he was negligent. All right, that the courts figure that out. But if it has been determined that he was not negligent, but he was inadvertent, right? It was a mistake. He didn't mean to do it, and it was a mistake, not negligence. I can't picture such a thing. Someone's kid hits someone that hard. I didn't know. I hit him in the wrong place. Okay. So Gemara says he doesn't go into galus because he was doing a mitzvah. Shnemar, Hosei Chano. Hosei Shivto, son Eveno. No question that Gemara understands Shivto to mean, the corporal punishment. Right? Okay, so Shmuel is correct. The word shevet can refer to also the tongue lash. Make sure that the kid gets disciplined. The kid is not disciplined. If you just want to be your kid's friend and you don't want to discipline them and tell them when they're doing something wrong, you will end up hating him. Or you're not being a good parent. So now, for the last 50 years, we reinterpret a possibility, which I wouldn't care to do in Mishlei Ben Sira. Now, look, people do this with Shakespeare also. Shakespeare meant one, Hamlet meant one thing for 200 years, now Hamlet means a whole new thing. That's legitimate. Okay, alright, so let's get back to our point here, is that the problem with the promises that Abraham is dealing with, right, is really the topic of Koheles, where that author, we were talking about that about 10 minutes ago, that author is aware that, hey, you know what, this is, I'm not going to say it's mostly a breach, but there are plenty of breaches to this. All right, so what's the answer that Talmud might give to this righteous sufferer and this wicked success? What answer would the Talmud give? Fourteen years of Jewish education, you can't pick. Come on, talk to me. What answer would the Talmud give? It's all over the Talmud. What answer would Rashi give to why we so such righteous Jews in France are suffering and these wicked.
Yisuris.
What?
Yisur
Okay, that's actually the same sentence on Dafe, the seventh prophet. Yisur of Shalava. That's a very complicated concept. Hit me more, God. I know you love me. Go ahead. My father, I know you don't want to hold back the blows because I deserve it. But what? Come on, what else? All right, Yisurim Shavit is indeed an answer. But this
some people will get rewarded, most people get rewarded in the world to come.
That's the Gemara's final conclusion, is that reward and punishment is not limited to this world. The righteous get all of their, most of their reward in the next world. Be careful about this, because when you see someone thriving too much, you can say, ah, he must be a Rashi, he's getting all of his reward in this world. The right, the wicked get the reward, right? Remember Mitzvah, they get it now, when they want it. The righteous have been taught to put off their reward for a future time. Right? I'll get it when it's more meaningful. This is a lifetime, this is a small little blip in the immortality of my soul. Whatever happens after it's not in my body anymore, okay, we can take that. This is a tiny blip. I prefer the reward much later, like all righteous people. Aren't you familiar with that? Koheles never relies on that. When the Meiri, you heard of the Menachem Meiri, 13th century, when he writes in his commentary to Koheles, why the rabbis felt that Koheles does not belong in Tanakh, he points to, he points to one specific, I think paraphrase, I'll just read it, it's at the end of Perek Gimel in Sefer Koheles, where I paraphrase in English, he says, who knows if the spirit of an animal and the spirit of a human being go to different places after they both die? It's very possible that wherever the animal goes and disintegrates into the ground, the person goes to the same place. And Mosar ha'adam in ha'be'ayim ki ha'kol say that at the end of that, on daily die. Right? How much greater is it to be a human being than to be a porcupine? Oh, yeah, Kol Havel, we're all disappearing anyway. Really? So the Meiri wonders, how could a pasuk let that be in Tanakh? He says, now I see why the rabbis wanted to take it out in Tanakh. So what does it mean? It was actually left in Tanakh. How do you explain this? Yes?
If it was such a problem, that pasuk, what is it in Radonin?
Why is it
in Radonin?
Because we have to understand what it means. Let's explain it. Right? So I just made reference to that Nadan. So the Meiri writes that Koheles wants to resolve the existential problems of man b'torat ha-mechkar. Let the Talmud give guarantees about what's going on after we die. Koheles' point is, written by a very wise man, Talmud says, is that the inconsistencies of life will be resolved with Chochmah. I admit there are limitations of Chochmah. Hamosif Chochmah, Mosif Machov. The more Chochmah you have, the more pain you will suffer. Right? And the... Right? So, Hamosif Chochmah, Mosif Machov. It might even add pain. Right, but the Meiri says that Koheles wants to resolve these issues with Chochmah and with what we would call Torah HaMechkar in English, probably empirical evidence. Since we have no empirical evidence to the resolutions we've just discussed here of what happens when our body and soul are separated, right? So I'm not going to include that in my book. To be sure, there are other books of Tanakh that give us this guarantee. Yeshayahu does, Daniel does, Yecheskel does. There seem to be psukim even in the Torah and Tehillim that seem to give such guarantees, so to say, for the faithful. Right? So the Koheles does not want to, because that's not the purpose of the book. The book is B'Torah HaMechkar. By the way, at the end of the book, it says, So Tavor HaKol Nishma Selukim Yirah. Just be a Yirah Shemayim. Seven times in the book, he reminds you, have Yirah Shemayim. It's not, this happens to be a pasuk in Tehillim. Reishis Chochmah Yiras Hashem. The Mesopotamian, the Sumerian also loved wisdom. But he did not see wisdom in terms of morality. Right? So that's Koheles. The same author, says the Talmud, writes the exact opposite kind of book. What's the most optimistic book in the Tanakh? By optimism, I mean that always get what I think Shir is the one that's sad is books of Tanakh. Why? What's sadder than two people
masking like each other? Esther's.
who don't read. Right? Of course, there are lots of books in Tanakh where there's a happy ending. Right? In that way, Eeyore is a happy book, right? Happy ending. So, you know, okay, that's the nature of fairy tales. We tell you, let me go along the way, once upon a time, with all these problems, right? And in the end, they're happily ever after. So, I think Zilim is a combination, we'll see, because you have to know your the whole corpus of the book. But there's a whole other book. The name of the book is by definition optimistic. I said, well, I gave it away. I said, it's the same author. The proverb must be optimistic. Right? Because I'm sort of guaranteeing you that the early bird gets the worm, right? Really? Sometimes the early bird gets up too early and gets run over by a truck, making an early delivery. I don't know. You know what I'm saying? A stitch in time saves nine. That's Ben Franklin. Right? Really? Sometimes if you stitch too fast, then you prick your finger and you die of an infection. I don't know. You can give yourself a... I teach Mishnah here, and I have a list of about 1,000... contemporary proverbs that all have their origins in Mishlei. Right? It's written a little differently. Forbidden fruit is sweeter. That's supposed to be Mishlei. There it's stolen water is sweeter. Mayim genuvim yutar. Why is it mayim? But anyway, the point is that Mishlei is filled with sort of these guarantees. There's guarantees on the bad side too. If you're lazy, the lazy man folds his hand and has nothing to eat. That's not optimistic. It's just meant it's meant to be optimistic for the person who's not lazy. But even that's not true. The lazy man sometimes folds his hand his whole life, buys a winning lottery ticket, and he'd be lazy for the rest of his life and eat all the food he wants. Right? Right? There's a great pasuk, even another one like that, says the lazy man folds his arms and in the end eats his own flesh. He has nothing else to eat. He's so lazy. Right? Not everybody. There's some lazy people who have inherited a lot of money. When I see that guy, I say, what are you doing to me, Mishlei? So here's the point. The optimism of Mishlei is not meant to teach you that this is the human condition or drought. Not every proverb ends up being true. Because there are exceptions to everything. It's just that play the percentages. Right? You have someone who smokes two packs of Camels every day for 60 years and cancer doesn't take him out. You have another guy who lives in a rural surrounding, never smoked, and dies of lung cancer. Who in this room doesn't know that dichotomy? I know someone that would never. The doctor said there's no explanation. He grew up in Muncie and he just comes down with lung cancer in his 20s. Fought it for but 3 or 4 years before it killed him. Right? And I know people who have, they smoked for 60 years. The doctors even said if you stop smoking, you'll get into trouble because your lungs have gotten so used to it. Right? Crazy. So, because there are exceptions to everything. Right? But Mishlei takes the opposite side of the Kohelis. Kohelis is pessimism, Mishlei is the optimism. Tehillim, I would say, is a combination of the two. You have to know all your Tehillim. We only say the optimistic ones, right? Tehillim has one pasuk, perhaps the most famous pasuk in Tehillim. Hinei lo yanum v'lo nishon shomer Yisrael, right? Sound familiar? God doesn't sleep, neither does he slumber. That's in chapter 121, very famously, Shir L'malos. Chapter 41 reads, Ura Hashem lama tishan, wake up God, why are you sleeping? Same book. Because it represents the different phases of our lives. And guess what? Life is contradictory. Okay. Now, you find Hayes points to a number of genres, and this has to be very early, much earlier than Socrates and Plato's Republic. But it is certainly the focus of the same works that, again, we haven't found anything on the the scope and size of about 31 chapters of Proverbs. You find a stone with four proverbs from Egypt or something that, you know, although Egypt has left us a tremendous amount of proverbial material, a lot of which parallels Mishlei. Right? And it's a lot older than our Mishlei. Why should that surprise anybody? I'm going to talk about thrift. Right? Don't be surprised that Shlomo, married to the daughter of the king of Egypt, was aware of Egyptian proverbs. And some of them made their way similarly into Sefer Mishlei. Not one, two, or three, but 40 or 50 or more. Okay? Don't be surprised. Nothing, you know. Then proof from that that Mishlei was just a retreaded Egyptian book of proverbs. For everything you want, every fantastic claim you want to make, we have an answer. Okay, here's an interesting thing that Hayes does. He shows that the parallelistic structure of Mishlei resembles the time period of Shlomo more than it resembles the time period of the Roman and Greek dialogues. And the same is true about Eov, by the way. Because Eov also moves into a different mode of the pursuit of wisdom, where you have you speak, then I answer, then you speak, then I answer, then you speak, then I answer. And we do it again, three times. We don't interrupt each other. At some point we're at each other's throats, no arguments, but we don't interrupt. And then at the end, a fourth person comes in and joins the discussion. Right? And then God comes in and says he was right and he was wrong. Okay, like the Deus Ex Machina that comes in at the end and fixes everything up. Right? Okay. The interesting thing there is that I can encapsulate all of the Eov's friends. I assume everybody knows the basic point of Eov, right? All of Eov's friends' arguments is the Hanosh Me'elawai Yitztok, shall man be more righteous than God? If you're suffering, Eov, don't put your suffering in God's doorstep. You must deserve it. If your children die, they must have done something to deserve to die. Because God doesn't harm man for nothing. Ki lo inam libo. And that's a pasuk in Eicha. But it fits. Right? God doesn't just have a whim, but of course the reader of Eov knows that that's pretty much exactly what happened. We call it a whim, but it was the Satan that sort of convinced God to do this. We have to go into our different opinions of what the Satan represents in the story. But when God tells the Satan after the first dare, if you want to call it that, the first dare, he goes, "You see, Satan, Eov still maintains his moral equilibrium, and you made me punish him for nothing. For nothing? People get punished for nothing? What is chinam? What does that mean? Right? What does that mean? What did you say before? Yisurim? Shalav?
Shalav, yeah.
Right? Really? Maybe? Let's try to discipline me? Maybe? If you hear this, I digress. This, when you all go to the next world, our deeds are put on the scale, right? So the scale of our mitzvahs is this white fluff. The scale of our averos is black coal. Okay. So this man the man who suffered very much his whole life. This is absolutely heresy. Was there a parallel between the suffering and his heresy? And he goes to the next world. He's online and watching as all the other, you know, white fluff and black hole are brought in, you know, on their sides, describing and put on the scales. And he sees the guy in front of him. There's all these big train with cattle cars with their white fluff going by and weighs it all and goes up. Send him on. He's going on straight to Olam Haba, and it's his turn to have everything weighed. And he sees all the cars coming by with all the black hole. And a little scooter drives up to bring his fluff. Right? Hundreds of cars of black coal and just a small little bag of white fluff. And he's expecting to go to Gehenna. When they say, wait, well, hold gone.
Then all of a sudden, more trains come with hundreds of cars of white fluff. He's looking and he says, wow, that's all that fluff. What are they doing? What are they being so righteous?
So the proprietor tells him, that white fluff is your suffering. Point, right? So they bring it all in, and the white fluff is just a little short of his, together with his scooter bag, a little short, doesn't just weigh enough to offset the black hole. So as he's being taken up to the bad place, he looks back and he says, God, couldn't you just make me suffer a little more? See, that was there's a film called Defending Your Life. You should see it. It's a great film. Just take 2 hours out and Defending Your Life. It's a great film. It's about 30 years old. It's dated. But it's about this defending your life after you die. And you have to do it to get on to the next step, the next stage of your existence. Anyway, that was the test. If he had just said, God, I regret not doing more mitzvahs, right? Then he would have gone on. But instead he said, God, couldn't you make me suffer a little more? Right? How are we getting that white stuff? Right? Okay, so back here. So, I point out to you again that there's tremendous issues of wisdom going back and forth with Mishlei and Eov in that now move into dialogue. And Hayes does us this great favor of preferring a much earlier date for Mishlei than the scholars say, just by the form and content of the structure of how the proverbs appear. Hayes, by the way, earlier in his book, An Introduction to Old Testament Study, did the same thing with the Torah. Get this? Because in the circles where Hayes walks, the Torah is written by 5 different authors. It's written by Yirmiyahu and Yechezkel and Ezra, and put together a little after Ezra. So that's how we discussed this earlier in the semester. But what Hayes does, amazing thing he does, is that he shows that the covenantal structures of the Torah, that would be in Parshas Mishpat, that would be in Parshas Bechukosai, that would be in Parshas Kisav, right? That would be in peppered throughout all the other books. Even in some senses in Bereishis. He says that he showed the covenantal structures of, if you do this to me, this will happen. If you do that to me, that'll happen. In other words, the good always comes first. Think of the Tochacha, if you will, right? And the bad is longer, right? And he goes to great detail to show the structure. And he says that in Assyrian times, that structure was drastically different. We have a lot more Assyrian information in Babylonia, as you already know in this semester. Assyrian material, and Persian material, but in when you go way back to Mesopotamian, Sumerian, Babylonian, Egyptian material, back to the time where the Torah is given according to our tradition, we see that the covenantal structures fit precisely with the Torah's structure. Just a few examples of it before. Fits more precisely with the Torah. In other words, he argues for a much earlier dating. Hayes doesn't agree that it's all one author, but at least he's willing to go back and say that it's dated much or to much earlier time as a result. He does the same thing with Mishlei here, because you know in the scholarly world, Mishlei takes its form much later. But he says no. Look at the structure, the parallelistic structure. Look at the form and content. And you'll see that it more closely resembles much older material. Okay, so this is the comparison with between the our wisdom material and that of the ancient Near East. Now, so if I ask you, what do you have to do to be a chacham? So Ezehu Chacham. Alright, so Baruch Hashem, we have the good fortune of studying a text that has an immense amount of commentary after it that was ever flowing from the time it was finished. Alright? So which is why, just think of this. Look how much English, the English language, has evolved from Shakespeare. Right? I have these books at home. Shakespeare with No Fear. So if you just read this straight text,
you know what his
metaphors means. You know what his some of his personifications. You have to know the way people were talking in England 300 years ago, right? Look how much the English language has evolved. And let's do one better. I'm sure at some point in your high school or college, probably more college experience, you've read some of Beowulf or Chaucer or some of that material, right?
Make your way through two lines in a row without some help. Look what's happened to the English language in 900 years.
How is it that an Israeli who speaks perfect Hebrew, who never opened the Tanakh, right, can open to this page and read? You may just have to tell him the structure of the Vav Haipuch. What does Vayishlach mean? He knows what Shalach means. Vayishlach Yehoshua et Ha'om. Vayelchu b'nei Yisrael ish l'nachalato lo reshet et ha'oretz. For goodness sakes, any Israeli will figure this out. In fact, I can go on and on. He's working with this whole text here. 3,000 years old. And he has no problem with this. I'll admit it's going to come up to some issues in some of the hard books, fine. But that's amazing. Right? So it's not only linguistically, this is moralistically. I have a Pirkei Avos that's going to tell me what it thinks Chochmah is. And it's not in a vacuum. Pirkei Avos' definition of Chochmah comes from Torah, from Mishlei, from, right? From Tehillim. Okay? Alright, so I would say the following. I stayed out of Bereishis, but let me close with Bereishis. Is that one of the main issues deal with a Zoroastrian, Mesopotamian, you believe in your deity, you believe in this, you're willing to give up your son, your firstborn son for your deity. These were firm people, right? You know, okay. So for them, the basic thrust of Chochmah is to magnanimously accept your fate. Right? This is Socrates as well. The most important midah for a Greek was courage, to accept your fate, which you cannot change. The Levian of Tanakh came to drastically change that. You can change. Your fate is in your hands. It's in your free will. So that's what makes a particular story in Bereishis one of the considered the greatest of all what we call sapiential literature stories. Sapiential, Homo sapien. That it is ancient world, it's the story of Yosef, of course, where at every turn, you know, life twists here or there. Some of life's twists can be traced back to something I myself did, right? Some of life's twists can be traced back to some things that I can't understand, but maybe hopefully one day later we'll understand, right? Sefer Bereishis, say some of the great narrative students will look at, you know, Yehuda, you see how you were shamed into admission when someone said, Haker no, do you recognize these items, says the harlot, to shame him into acknowledging that he did go to one, right? Who said those exact same two words? Haker no. That's what Yehuda said to his father when he showed him a coat drenched in blood. Haker no. You recognize this coat, Daddy? Whose is it? Right? Yehuda brought it to him. So Bereishis is the quintessential wisdom literature of our sources that bring up the amazing ironies of life. Yaakov, you're not going to get away scot-free by making believe that you are the older brother. What an irony that in the very next story, after he has to go into flight over his brother's fury, he falls in love with a younger sister and gets the older sister. Get it? And when he confronts his father-in-law with the chicanery, he says, Lo yaseh kein bimkomeinu lo seis hatzi'iru lifnei ha'bechira. We didn't say, we don't, in our place, we don't give the younger ones before the older ones. What's the implication? Like you do. I heard that story. Make papers. Right? In fact, because I'll say that Leah herself told it to Yaakov. When you woke up in the morning, you said, hey, wait a second. How could you do this to your sister? Your sister's been waiting 7 years for me. And she said a little snarkiness that made him not really like her too much. What did she say? And you didn't do something similar to your brother? Leah told him in the morning when he realized he wasn't with the one he wanted. He said, okay, you don't owe me anything. Well, why don't you do this to your sister? Right? Well, how'd you go in for this? Well, my father put a knife to my throat. He said, he'll kill me if I don't. Come on. Who forced you? Like, Rachel was probably tired of someplace. She didn't show up the way. So, who forced you to do this? You know, so she said, wait, and wait a second. You didn't do something similar to your brother? Right? So Bereishis is filled with those ironies. Life is ironic. Right? So you have to learn. You have to learn for yourself. Always be a mensch on a date. You never know. She may set you up with her friend if it didn't work. Right? Don't burn any bridges. That's the chachma of the Torah is think about what's going on down the line. And that's really just the chiddush of chapter 12 of Koheles. Koheles chapter 12 is all about making sure that down the line everything works for you. Sof davara kol nishma. Think of Yitzchak. It's Yitzchak liyom acharon. That's one of the last psukim in Mishlei. Right? Always think, how does this reflect on something that I may be concerned about later? Have you ever studied where they took this amazing, I don't know how they just didn't do something about it, but they took about 400 kids to be a large study. They had 3 years old. It's obviously a long study. 400 kids, and they offered them two pieces of licorice an hour from now, or one piece right now. And they took a record of who wanted the one now, and who was willing to put it off for an hour from now and get twice as much. And they just took the decisions, and then they checked out where are these kids 30 years later. And by just such an incredibly a skewed measure of success, again, I'll admit there are many different measures of success, but just by a whole host of measures of success, how their marriage is doing, how much money they're making, where they're living, where their kids are, of course there are a lot, that's what they had to do with so many. But they just showed that the ones who were willing to put off satisfaction for a later time, it just, if that's the way we like it, three, it just shows that they got this message. Right? Okay, so that's what Yosef does. It's the greatest story because, okay, keep your magnanimity. Don't go crazy here in jail. There must be a reason why you're here. Right? That's, you know, don't take vengeance because just try to figure out why this is happening. I know you want to act impetuously, you want to get even, but okay, just figure it out, just work it through, and hopefully Batis Hakli Maharal. Okay, so we just have one more day on Thursday.